This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. We build, craft if you will, the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors, and this is the one where at long last we managed to nail the mystery night bird.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and a warm welcome to a morning of rare and witchy beauty. I came out of the house this morning at about 5 o'clock and there was a bright yellow moon hung in the western sky. Clear, clear skies, frost on the ground, skeins of mist. In the east, the sky was just pink, just a wall of pink. It was fabulous. And that's all cleared now. And the sun is shining in the spire in Midstocket Road. I'm Mark Stephen. I'm in the car park in BBC Aberdeen. Join him this weekend from his stately home in rural Bampshire, Lord McElraith.
I got out of bed about 4:30 this morning, took Bracken for a walk, and I just stood and just in awe. The sun was just peeping over the horizon, seemed bigger than it's ever been, not a cloud in the sky, gentle frost. The badger had been digging up the tulips again, but it was just one of those fantastic mornings, and it still is. It's just possibly the best morning of the year.
The forecast is looking good for the weekend. We've been making the most of the sunshine. I've been back on my bike completing the Aberdeen Coastal Trail. With that in mind, here's a question. Childhood memories of holidays, you know, in Scotland, preferably, as it looks like we're going to be staying in the UK for our summer holidays. Do you intend ever going back to them? Is that a mistake? Get in touch, let us know.
Yeah, I was thinking about it this morning. I remember going on a holiday down to Melrose with my parents. And it was one of those silly memories of... There was a Danish couple in the caravan next door. Oh. And they gave us two wooden horses, those red wooden horses that Danish folk are really into. And just tell us your stories. Email out of doors at bbc.co.uk.
Maybe a legal requirement in Denmark. You know, if you're going to leave the country, you have to take a big bag of those red horses with you to trade with the natives.
Well, if it was something like that, I mean, they must have had a whole boot full of them. And this week, you've all been waiting for it. Here's the mystery bird, and nobody's going to get this. But I'm quite proud of this recording. Yep.
Was that it?
Well, that was it. You were with me, and we're not going to give away the location. But I just got a snippet of it. Yeah, call Sam, 0808 92 95 00.
Now, our Scotland Outdoors podcast guest this week was an old friend of this programme, a recently retired Radio Orkney colleague, Dave Gray.
He did a stint on here on Out of Doors. He was presenting quite regularly for a while. But first he told us about how he got involved in radio.
I always say that once you'd done a stint at Radio Orkney, you could do everything. You could report, you could edit, you could drive the desk, you could do the technical stuff, because everybody did everything. So there was no specialisms at Radio Orkney. It was generalisms. Everybody could do everything. But it was one of those kind of opportunities that I got. I was a mechanic. I worked at the garage across the road for Radio Orkney, and You know, I had a chance meeting with John Ferguson at the airport one day. I was there collecting somebody, and I sat down, the plane was delayed, and I just started speaking to John Ferguson. I didn't really know him that well, but, you know, knew of him. We're having a discussion, and he came up with a very dangerous question. Do you listen to Radio Orkney? Which, whatever answer you gave, it's not really the right one. So I said, well, I don't really listen to Radio Orkney that much because they don't have anything on that I particularly am interested in. What are you interested in? I says, I like heavy metal music and cars. So he said, right, okay, well, why don't you come across and do a heavy metal program? And there was a bit of a laugh and a bit of banter. We had a cup of coffee, and I, to be honest with you, I thought nothing more of it. I went back to work. A couple of days later, Ferg phoned up, and he says, "Say, when are you coming across to do that heavy metal program?" And I thought, my goodness, he's actually serious. So I went across the road. I got shown the equipment. These are the CD players. These were record players in those days. Record players, a CD player over in the corner, the kind of brand new CD player. And I was basically left for the next 4 or 5 weeks. I came in at night, practiced, went home, came back in the next night and practiced. And after about 6 weeks, I'd gotten to the stage where I felt reasonably at home with the equipment. I felt as if I could put records on. I felt as if I could speak into a microphone, that type of thing. And he said, okay, that's it. And he just announced that there was a brand new Radio Orkney heavy metal program starting. The audience was asked if they wanted to name it. Somebody suggested the name Metallic Grey. I didn't particularly like it at the time, but unfortunately I was overruled and it became Metallic Grey. And I did Metallic Grey every Friday night for the next 6-7 years or so. And that was who I cut my teeth with live broadcasting. I always say the best grounding ever in broadcasting is to do live from day one, because once you can do live, you can do anything. You'll be unfazed by anything at home. So I was allowed in purely by accident, you know, the kind of one of those kind of serendipity type things that you read about. I had no experience. I had no idea. I left school with hardly any qualifications at all. I'm not qualified to do that particular job in any shape or form, other than the fact that I've been doing it for years and years and years. So really one of that kind of in the right place at the right time moments.
The live program we do, the Ewan and I do, Out of Doors. You did a stint in Out of Doors for a while, didn't you?
I did, Mark. I was so lucky. Right through my career, I've been sort of taken under a number of different wings of older, more experienced folk and really gotten a bit of a boost. Now, at that particular time, I was kind of under the wing of John Ferguson, and I was also under the wing of a guy called Andrew Jones, who you'll know for years gone past. Andrew was in charge in Aberdeen. And when Out of Doors was presented by Freda Morrison, Freda used to regularly go on holiday, and there was this question about who's going to present Out of Doors. Now, Andrew, I know for an absolute fact, must have pushed me and said, oh, we've got this guy in Orkney, we can get him doing to present Out of Doors. And so I was invited doing, and in them days it was all recorded the day before. And I went doing on the kind of Thursday, and we recorded Out of Doors, and I went back up to Orkney again. And one thing I hadn't been used to was the kind of level of feedback. I just thought, oh, it'll go out and that'll be it, and I'll maybe get a couple of messages for folk in Aberdeen that I know or something. I got messages for all over the place. I got a letter for the Scots Tongue Society congratulating me on maintaining my strong Orkney accent. I got letters for all over the place asking me about Orkney, asking me about Orkney words, that type of thing. And it was just phenomenal. And to be able to go down and do that. So you got that experience, and then you're able to come back up to Orkney again. But it was the fact that everything that I'd done up until that point was live. And I sort of said to the guys on Out of Doors, can't we do it live? And they kind of went, well, I don't know about that live. It was all a bit kind of weird and wonderful. I was allowed to do it live one time, and it all worked well. And I think it's funny now, because of course Out of Doors now is the absolute epitome of live, when it used to be all kind of slightly pre-prepared and recorded. But I mean, now it's everything is live and it's out there, which is a huge part of the program's likability, is the fact that it's right there, it's happening. You can imagine you guys standing there doing it. So it's people like live. I think the listeners appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Dave, for being responsible for us getting up at 4:30 in the morning.
Swine. Absolute swine. You can hear the whole of that interview with Dave by looking up the Scotland Outdoors podcast on BBC Sounds. Lovely guy. Lovely guy.
I really urge you. There's quite a lot of response on social media to that. It was just absolute fun. Joe Carner in Aberdeen got in touch and she said, I'm sitting cleaning out my polytunnel ready for its move to my new allotment and listening to an interview did with Dave Gray. I'm not often moved to writing in, but I really wanted to congratulate you both and Dave on a superb episode that had me smiling from start to finish. What a lovely guy, and I wish him all the best for his retirement. And that you'd have to listen to the whole thing to make sense of this. She wishes him well with his mobile composting toilet.
You don't get this in other programmes.
No, you absolutely don't. Yeah,
and Graham Adams said, thanks very much for the midweek podcast. I was listening while doing some dishes at the sink, and I had tears from laughing so much. I could listen to that man reading the phone book. It's only a matter of time before we get punted off to some retirement phone and they bring in Dave Gray. Too popular by half, I would say.
I can just see Dave getting on the ferry as we speak.
That's it. There have been a couple of stories recently of dogs, well, certainly last summer there was, dogs and horses in the northeast being bitten by adders. It's not a great experience, but it usually has a happy ending. You get straight to a vet for anti-venom.
Yeah, this is the time of year when the adders start waking up. It reminded me of a piece I did back in 2019 with Catch Going on a Reed at the Muir of Dinnet National Nature Reserve.
We're going to go down to see if we can spot some adders. It's not ideal conditions for them because they aren't keen in the wind, they aren't keen in the cold, and they aren't keen on the rain. And right about now, it's doing all three
We've
of those.
Got all of that. I'm going to come clean here. I've done this job for 30 odd years, I've never seen an adder. Never.
Well, Muir of Dinnet is one of the best places to see. I mean, there are certain tips you can take with you whenever you go out in the countryside if you are specifically looking for adders. One is to watch your feet. They are beautifully camouflaged and you can often nearly tread on them by accident. And they do like lurking in amongst dead bracken, so they look very like dead bracken.
So how serious is a bite?
It varies. It varies hugely. They won't actually inject you with venom every single time they bite because they want you to back off. They can't poison you and eat you, so there's actually not really much point in them poisoning you if they can avoid it. But bites can be very serious. They can be fatal, but nobody's died of an adder bite for over 40 or 50 years.
Have you been bitten?
No, I would like to think I'm sensible and stay well back from them because it's all about respect, isn't it? If you see something like that, you can have a look at it, but with modern cameras, you can get so close to seeing things or with binoculars that you don't have to get too close to these things. And I never try and pick them up and touch them because, well, see, it's just
a stupid thing to do.
Yeah, it's a stupid thing to do, and it's about respecting the animal and its privacy and its space.
So you train to suck the venom out? He said, hopefully.
No, you certainly don't do that if you ever get bitten by a snake of any sort. All the stuff you see in cowboy films where people bleed themselves or suck venom out, it doesn't really work and is probably, if anything, liable to make things worse.
So what should you do? Hopefully it's not going to happen.
If anybody gets bitten, you should immobilise the limb that's bitten and dial 999. So, yeah, as I was saying, you're out in the countryside and you're adders, you know, looking for adders. So you can't certainly keep an eye on your feet. But if you've got any sort of south-facing banks or dikes or walls, something with a bank behind it, and maybe a bit of overhead cover too, that's often a good place to try and keep an eye out for adders. Because it's south-facing, it's warm. A bit of overhead cover means predators won't spot the adders so much. Because though we think of adders as being very, very dangerous, there are actually plenty of things out there that will do damage to an adder.
What would take an adder?
Your very, very worst thing, you'll never guess, it's a pheasant.
Wow.
Pheasants are the worst. They're not predators of adders, but they kill them. It makes sense if you think about it. Pheasants are native to the UK. They were introduced from Asia. And they evolved in Asia. Now, out in Asia, there are some serious snakes. There are cobras, there are pythons. There's really dangerous stuff out there. So it makes sense these birds don't like snakes and they know how to deal with them. So they peck around the head, they can blind them, they can crush their skull, they'll stamp and scrape with the spurs and their feet. They really don't like adders and can possibly be one of the worst things for adders.
Okay, where are we going now? There's one on that
wall. Follow the path down and round and we'll come at it from the bottom because if we walk down the hill we're less likely to see adders because we're more likely to scare them before we spot them. So we'll come at this from the bottom.
Okay, so do you think in the bracken?
I think in the bracken. I will, if you don't mind, walk slightly ahead of you for a moment.
Feel free.
And I'll see if I can spot any.
Well, you carry on, I'll wait here. Right, Katrina's actually wearing gaiters in case she does get bitten. And so am I. It's quite exciting. Just treading very carefully. You'd have to have a really good eye to spot one in this. So well camouflaged. Right, Katrina's just giving me a thumbs up, which I'm really excited. Never seen an adder. I'm going gently as well.
You walk along this grassy bit and then just look back round that lump there, you'll see it. It's a male. You walk. Don't let your shadow fall on them if you can help it.
Oh, I can see him.
Got him?
Yeah, that, it's much blacker than I thought, with a very white tan markings.
Yeah, they vary hugely in colour, from almost pitch black to a very, very pale beige-brown colour, with always the black zigzag down their back.
So how long would that be?
Ooh, that's a good
question.
It's
quite well coiled up.
Yeah, they're longer than you think. I mean, that'll be certainly over a foot. That would probably be about 18 inches, I would think.
Oh, I can see the head now. I can see the tongue flicking.
I can see the tongue flicking. He's possibly scenting us. I would think we're downwind at the moment. We can speak fairly confidently, provided we don't start shouting. It's vibration from our feet, they'll feel, so you walk softly rather than walk normally.
So he probably knew we were coming.
He probably knew we were coming, but he's happy enough at the moment. If we stamped our feet, I suspect he'd disappear off into the bracken, because adders with their whole body on the ground work by vibration. So if something stamps, they feel that vibration, and that alerts them to whether something's coming close.
And if we're doing that deliberately, presumably we're breaking the law.
You're not actually, it's illegal to injure adders, but not to disturb them, though, I mean, obviously it's morally unethical to do so. It's a shame, because people still do get a little bit freaked about snakes, and I suppose along with the red deer, they're the one of the few bits of British wildlife that could actually do you some damage if they chose to.
I think he's seen us now, he's kind of stiffened up a bit.
Yeah, it could just be the wind. Sometimes they'll change position when there's a particularly cold gust of wind goes through, a bit like you and I, sort of, burr and shiver. He possibly has. It's our shadows we're mostly going to have to watch. We don't let fall on him. So
we shall leave him. I'm really impressed. Usually you turn up and you get, you should have been here yesterday.
I've heard that myself plenty of times when I've been wildlife watching. Yeah, yeah.
There it is. One adder.
Yeah, there's possibly another one there, but I will check and see if I can spot that for you in a minute as well with my binoculars.
Yes, I'm happy with one. Thank you very much.
That's quite all right.
Catriona Reid at the Muir Dinnet Nature Reserve back in 2019 there.
Fantastic. I just love it when somebody says, yeah, I'll show you an adder. Yeah. And usually it doesn't happen, and she took me straight to it. We went on to see another two, because I've spent how many years doing this programme and never seen an adder, and it was just lovely. This time of year, watching them basking in the sun, but there have been a couple of bites already.
I was getting my collar felt by our senior producer, Helen, there, saying, it has happened this week. And I went, oh, yeah, fair enough. I've missed that, obviously. I'm not up on this. So just carcanny. And obviously, they're beautiful animals, but don't unnecessarily disturb them. I remember coming across a bunch of hikers in, I'm trying to think, it was near Rower Dennet, beside Loch Lomond. And they were kind of around something on the path and kind of poking it with a stick and saying, no, please don't do that, just leave it alone and, you know, it'll move on harmlessly by itself. Thank you very much. Anyway, here's something else that you might be interested in coming up on BBC Radio Scotland.
We know our children and young people care about the planet we live on. We want to hear what they have to say about climate change in a brand new writing competition.
Aye, it's true the world's on fire, but it's going to light our spark.
Climate Tales from BBC Radio Scotland.
In 500 words or less, we're asking for short stories, poems, spoken word pieces, monologues, or even raps, all about climate change. The competition is open to those aged between 5 and 16 on the 30th of June 2021, and you'll have until the end of that day to enter. For all the details, terms and privacy notice, head to bbc.co.uk/climatetales.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. We're going to be chatting to one of the judges of that Climate Tales competition, Rory Crawford, just after 7 o'clock.
Yeah, first of all,
the mystery bird, and very disappointingly, a couple of people have got it right. But first of all, have a wee listen. Now, that's very short, but we will have a longer version.
Coming
that
from you,
I
that's
didn't
rich.
Record. Well, I was really impressed. Well, the recorders we have take a while to warm up.
They do.
And usually, you know, about 30 seconds and the thing's gone. But anyway, we've got a wee bit of it. If you do know what that is, well, hats off to you. Out of doors at bbc.co.uk.
Due to your rather bizarre professional habit of never deleting anything, you know, you can have a 16 gigabyte, you know, memory card on your machine, and by the time it's actually initialised all that and fired up, you basically need to start recording the day before.
You do get recorders, and I've never managed to find one that actually record before you switch it on.
Yeah.
You know, it's got five... Anyway, we're boring the nation.
No, nobody cares. Yes, Helen's just said yes. Yes, you are. We've got some incorrect guesses here for the mystery bird. Lillian Forrest thinks it's a green woodpecker, and no, it's not. As did Barry Sutherland, our South Yorkshire ornithological correspondent. He says, my childhood memory of holidays is the Embo two-hole. I think it might be tin-hole. In my head, it was always an old tin-hole. Thank you. Lorna McGregor, Aberfeldy. Is it a peregrine falcon? Nope. Peter Robertson, Balerno, says... Is it a buzzhawk? Buzzhawk?
Buzzhawk?
Not sure. See, you could... don't know. Rightly know. We're having a bit of a discussion on this in our headphones at the moment because it's entirely possible that Sam has misheard this and then just typed it down. Paul Gibson, the people, says green woodpecker. Stephen Bain Westry says sounds like herring gull. Elspeth Cauldrum says... talking about us, I've never seen one until one day I ended up seeing one and a quarter. We think a bird had got one and just left its tail, which was still wriggling. On that happy note, enjoy your breakfast. As I said, I'll be continuing my journey along the Aberdeen Coastal Trail on my bike. The route runs from Cove to Donmouth, taking in a whole variety of sights and sounds.
You've got to be impressed by these things. I'm in Aberdeen Harbour on the south side. I started off at the battery at Torrey and I've cycled my way around here, and I'm just trying to keep out the way of the traffic, which is big and busy and industrial. And in front of me, there's the Eavoli Ivory, which is one of these oil supply vessels. And there's lifeboats on the back, but built above the bow, actually above the bridge itself, there's a helicopter landing pad. It's impressive. It's nose-to-nose with the Troms Lyra. Across there, there's a Northlink ferry. Off to my left, there's another Northlink ferry, the Hjaltland. I think that's the one that goes to Shetland. And behind it all, you've got the spires of Aberdeen City. The one thing I'm not looking forward to is getting round the corner of the harbour, which is a very busy junction, and make my way round to Fitty. Fitty's fine and quiet. I'll be honest with you, I'm not cycling on the road. I'm too feared to cycle on the road. The traffic's just ridiculous. Well, unfortunately, I might have to come off and cross at some stage, I don't know how. Now, in amongst the old Victorian warehouses, and everything here is made of granite blocks, probably at a Rubislaw quarry. Yep, we're back with big lorries again.
I saw the harbour lights, they only told me we were parting. The same old harbour lights that once brought you to me.
Now this is the old harbour I remember. It's this lovely bell-shaped tower, which used to be the sort of nerve centre for the harbour. And they built a new one, which kind of looks like Darth Vader's thumb. But that point there, just beside the tower, there is a little breakwater goes out. I remember standing in there, it's quite a young lad, probably about 6 or 7. And the shop in Fitty was run by the Leapers. And Jimmy Leaper was the son. Even then he must have been, I don't know, early 50s, something like that. But he would fish off that breakwater with a rod for mackerel, with feathered lures. And he would come up with 6 or 7 fish at a time. I just thought it was magic. I'm just in the outskirts of Fitty. And Fitty, or to give it its posh Sunday name, Foot Dee, lies, as the name suggests, at the foot of the River Dee. And this was an old fishing village. And my mother's side of the family are from here. My great-grandfather, or possibly great-great-grandfather, I can't remember which, used to be one of the pilots at Aberdeen Harbour. And my grandmother, Ma, used to say, "Kenneth, you're right like him." And all right, fair enough. And then she showed me a photograph of him. And he was about 5 foot tall and about 5 foot broad, in a walrus moustache and a bowler hat. And I said, "Ma, in what universe am I anything like that man?" She looked at me, she says, "In mannerism." Oh, well, fair enough. One of the characteristics of Fitty is the fact that there's these wee lanes, you can't get traffic in here. And each house had its wee sheddy. And again, they're painted in whites and blues and greens and reds, very colourful.
I saw the harbour light.
This house has got significance for me, because it's where my great aunt Elsie used to stay. It was built, and I know this because the keystone tells me this, in 1894. Three stories high. And when we used to come here, there was no inside toilet. And the water had to be collected from this standpipe here. And I remember it yet. It was one of those white enamel buckets with a blue rim, and it had a wooden cover. And we'd come here and fill up the bucket and then struggle back upstairs with it. Folk just lived on top of one another then. I just love these wee sheds. Now, some of them are two stories, so that you could sleep in them in the summertime. It's very, very Norwegian.
But you were on the ship, and I was on the shore.
So it's got a lovely wee garden here. Lots of primula and primroses. Narcissi. You can hear the sea as well. Hello. There are some very, very, very trendy sheds down here nowadays. Wait to hear this. Well, high tide at the moment, so the sea is right up to the seawall. And Aberdeen Beach is split nowadays with these wooden groins that run down and basically hold the sand in place, because otherwise everything would head south for the winter.
The general consensus is amongst the team is that we're going to drop the rest of the programme and just play that music out for the
next
hour. I
just love that image of you with your little trailer and the phonograph at the back playing along.
No, it wasn't a phonograph, it was a live band. It was a live band. The initial version of Harbour Lights there was Roy Fox, and then latterly it was the Platters. But, you know, frankly, we could just sit there and listen to it all day.
Well, I was swaying away, and throughout the nation was as well. It's a delightful image.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Now, Fitty is a lovely place, but I mean, it's really getting quite arty now, too. You know, some of those wee sheddies have been done up in the sort of, you know, almost like New England style. And it's, don't move the pebble. I changed that, you know, I put that in exactly the right place I wanted. Coming up, we're back in Cathcart Cemetery with Robbie Armstrong and Peter Ross. I relive some more of my childhood holidays in Aberdeen Beach. Tell us your favourite holiday destinations. We've got quite a few coming through already. Some lovely stuff here. I'm going to touch on them just in a second. And Ewan, here's the true tale of the monocled mutineer.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. I was filming with Landward earlier in the week, but before that, disappointingly, quite a few people have actually managed to identify this mystery bird. Now, quite a lot of people getting this wrong, Mark.
Indeed. Willie near Breathen thought it was a black-throated diver. David Chadwick and Carl Luke says, loon. To which I reply, men. That's right. A sort of northeast Doric joke. Karen in Shetland says, is it a kittiwake? Nope. David Portree says, is the mystery bird a northern goshawk? No. Although Mike and Forrest thought it was a goshawk too. Michael Craig and John Saven thought it was a goshawk. Says he's been privileged enough to hear them before at Montreathmont Forest outside Brechin in Angus. And adds, hopefully you'll be doing a dawn chorus programme very soon. As a matter of fact, Michael. As a matter of fact.
Had me back. Yeah, next week. Next weekend. We'll give you details about that next Saturday. But we'll be walking wall-to-wall dawn chorus. In fact, I was listening to it this morning, and up until now, the song thrush has been dominating, but it's been ousted by the blackbird, as you can hear in the background.
Indeed, you know, it's just quite, it's just burbling away quite nicely in the background there. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Ewan and I both heard something in the wee smile. Well, it was in wee smile. It was about 9 o'clock at night. It was dark, anyway. But what I heard was flying around my house. Now, we think we've got a recording of this now. Ron, are you in a position to actually play this in? So it's just the one note, and it's kind of goes, kind of falls down, goes dun, dun, and it was that kind of pacing. Earlier this week, I spoke to two lovely guys, Ian Broadbent and Mark Sullivan, about something called the Northeast Bird Report, and we've got that coming up in following weeks. But having two bird experts standing in front of me, I did the logical thing.
Right, I'm not going to ask you a daft question.
No daft question.
Oh, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. You know, in the old days, you know, in record shops, somebody like me would wander in and say to the guy behind, the long-suffering guy usually behind the counter, have you got that record with a tune that goes, you know, and they suddenly go, oh, God, you know, right. Both you and I heard a bird about 9 o'clock at night. We haven't heard it before. Now, obviously, it's a nighttime call. It seemed to be flying around my house. He, the very same night, heard something similar about 40 miles to the north. But it was this sort of cry. It was like a single note, but it fell. So it sort of went...
Golden plover flying over. Golden plover.
Yeah.
Heading golden back plover. To the mountains.
Yeah.
Result!
I've been working on that impersonation.
It's very good. One of the trends that's recently emerged over the last few years with technology is what they call nocturnal migration recording. Mm-hmm. So people get microphones, recorders like you've got here, hang them out the window during the night and leave them running all night, and then analyse what bird calls have been going over during the hours of darkness. And that's revealed some really interesting things. There's nocturnal migration sessions gone over at Inchgarth here, and people have been picking up species that I've never actually seen during the day here. Yeah. But they picked them up on call during the hours of darkness.
Chuck, I am dead chuffed at that.
Well, I'm just astounded that they both got that right.
Yeah.
The knowledge that some people have is just truly mind-bending.
Not us, obviously, but them. Ian Broadbent and Mark Sullivan there, and you can hear me chatting to Ian and Mark about that Northeast Bird Report on next week's programme.
OK, so we've done that when we've flogged it for about a month now.
A couple of weeks ago, we heard author and journalist Peter Ross telling our colleague Robbie Armstrong about the history of Cathcart Cemetery. In this speak, as they continue their tour of the cemetery, Peter tells Robbie some of just fascinating, amazing stories of the folk who are buried there.
I consider this cemetery and many large Victorian cemeteries to be libraries of the dead. You know, 15,000 stones here, and each of them has its own story to tell. This is the grave of Mark Sheridan. It says Mark Sheridan, comedian, and that he died in the year 1918. Now, when I first came to the cemetery, I was caught by that grave. I wondered who he was. And it turns out that Mark Sheridan is the reason that we all know the song, I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. It was his 1909 recording of that song that made it the kind of universal folk song that it's become. And very sadly, he died in Glasgow very suddenly when he was on tour here in 1918. And that's how he's come to be buried on this hill, you know, so far from the sound of the Silvery Sea.
I do like to be beside the sea. I do like the sound along the pump.
It was seeing Mark Sheridan's grave that was really the acorn that planted the book for me. I thought there must be stories like that across the whole of the UK, and so I set out to find them. But I think it really is an extraordinary thing that you can stand here at Mark Sheridan's grave and listen to him sing "I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside" from 9 years before he died, with all that lovely gramophone hiss. It really is a form of time travel. And it's the fact that people have smartphones that's really opened up cemeteries for people. Because as you walk around, you can see a name or something else that can catch your eye, and you can whip out the phone and begin to look them up and begin to kind of read the story of their life. It really is an extraordinary thing, an amazing development. And right next to it here, this kind of fallen down large cross, is the grave of Jessie McLaughlin, who was a singer of Gaelic song. She sang for Queen Victoria at Balmoral, and she was the first person to record Gaelic, a Gaelic song for the gramophone. So it's, and they're almost exact contemporaries, Sheridan and McLaughlin, so it's really fascinating that they've come to have their graves almost right next to each other. And I believe there's a... Jessie McLaughlin's cross has fallen down. I think there's a fundraising campaign to try to have that restored. So it'd be amazing to see that raised up again.
And this part... So this is the place that you were referring to as the jungle.
Once you go into the interior, that's the jungle in there. You know, you'll soon know it once you're in it. You might never come out again. This is the grave of Madge Jefferson, who is best known as the mother of Stan Laurel, of Laurel and Hardy fame. When I first came to this cemetery, this grave was completely unmarked, and it was shown to me by a member of the Laurel and Hardy fan club, the Sons of the Desert, who wear the fezzies. And more recently, someone has taken it upon themselves to put a very simple plywood cross on the grave and a little plaque saying, "In memory of Margaret Jefferson, 22nd of October 1860 to the 1st of December 1908, mother of comic actor Stan Laurel." Now, I'm sure that isn't a member of the family that have done that. I think it's just someone that felt that that grave ought to be marked. I kind of wish that it said more about who she was as a person in her own right rather than just the mum of Stan Laurel, because she was a music hall performer here in Glasgow and elsewhere, and I'd like to see a bit more about that. But I think it is great that we have this strange connection to this international superstar, and also that people can now find the grave. Just be careful coming under here. I'm always thinking this huge branch is going to fall down.
Oh, yeah. It does look... It looks, like, pretty cracked, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So this is my favourite grave in the whole of Cathcart Cemetery. I just think it's absolutely extraordinary, and it's a little bit off the beaten track, so you have to kind of know this is here to find it. It's the grave of the architect, William Gardner Rowan, who died in 1924, and his family. And I think he must have designed it himself. It's a really almost kind of feverish, hallucinatory, neo-Gothic design. You know, it's neo-Gothic and then some. You know, it's got a cross at the centre with the Lamb of God in the middle, and it's got representations of the four Gospels at the four corners. And the main thing that catches your eye, I think, is all this really difficult to read Gothic script, almost Germanic kind of Gothic script that's carved into this red sandstone. I mean, once you get your eye in, you can actually read it, but it isn't easy. It says here in the centre, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain." Around the cross it says, "I am Alpha and Omega." But it took me a long time to be able to decipher all this stuff. And then further down, you've got the kind of the details of his family that are buried here. One of my occupations during lockdown, me and my children have been to kind of come here and begin to clean this up a bit. Because when we first discovered it, it was covered with moss, really up to about stomach height on me.
So we began to very carefully scrape off a lot of the kind of moss, and we found and discovered this pelican carving down at the bottom. It shows a pelican feeding her own blood to her chicks, which is a kind of Christian symbol representing Christ's blood sacrifice, I think. It's just been lovely to be able to come here and to begin to uncover something which has been forgotten and which is really very beautiful and striking and unusual.
I lived in the Caribbean and taught English there, and on All Saints, Toussaint, it was the French Caribbean, so they've got like some of the Catholic sort of religious celebrations. And on Toussaint, All Saints, all the people would go to the cemetery and they would celebrate the dead, and the atmosphere was like so different to anything I'd experienced before. People would bring like candles, radios, who'd play music, people would drink beer, and they would like clean up the grave. And it's just interesting you talking about sort of coming here, albeit not clean the grave of someone you knew, but there's still that reverence or appreciation or something like that for people who aren't here anymore, and a sort of respect.
Yeah, I mean, this man, William Rowan, if he did design this grave himself, then he made an extraordinary thing, and I think it deserves to be seen, it deserves to survive. I just think it's good to come here and try to help out his creation a little bit. And to me, it's just this oddity, a fantastic oddity, and I'm so glad it's here.
Author Peter Ross there talking to Robbie Armstrong, and there's a link to Peter's website where you can find out more about his book, A Tomb with a View, on our website. I asked earlier for stories about early childhood, you know, holidays. C. and Aaron says, first caravanning holiday, early 50s, in a dank, dripping forest beside Loch Lubnig in the middle of nowhere. Very spooky. Caravan turned out to be an ancient furniture removal van. Big bed above the driver's cab, not much else. I remember smoky fires, lots of sausages and beans. Dad had bought his wartime billy can and a huge blackened frying pan, and long walks to fetch water from a farm tap. No car, because there was no road. My folks trekked in with a 7-year-old, 5-year-old, 4-year-old, brackets me, and a baby. How on earth did they do it? And yet it was enchanting. I've never tired of remote crumbling caravans and bothies ever since. Loving the programme, as always. Well, thank you very much for that. Excellent. We're trailing early the fact that Radio Scotland are going to be trying to encourage the nation's young writers to put pen to paper and just unleash their creativity by submitting new pieces of writing around the theme of climate change. Climate Tales is a new competition for young people aged between 5 and 16 years of age, and we're joined live this morning by one of the judges, marine biologist and TV presenter Rory Crawford. Good morning, Rory. How are you?
Good morning, not too bad, thanks.
Excellent. Yeah, I know you've got young kids yourself. I mean, but the thought of, you know, a 5-year-old writing something for this, is that just utterly bizarre?
I don't think so. And I think this sort of generation of kids have better language for speaking about climate change than many adults do. And I think because, you know, they've been sensitised to it because they have to be. So I think they have a way of expressing themselves in a frank and clear way that many adults can struggle with, you know. So, yeah, I've got young kids, and, yeah, I mean, I'm not 5 yet, but I think a lot of children are able to express themselves very clearly about this issue and creatively as well.
Now, you work as a marine scientist for the RSPB. I mean, I guess you're seeing the sharp end of climate change. How excited are you about this competition? Because you might get nothing, or you might get absolutely mind-blowing writing.
Well, I'm hoping we do get some entries, and obviously, you know, it being on Radio Scotland will hopefully help, and folk can go on to bbc.co.uk/climatetales to stick their entries in. So we're hoping for a few. I am excited about this because I was just listening to a podcast the other day called How to Save a Planet, and they were talking about the lack of an anthem for the climate movement. So you think about the civil rights movement, things like We Shall Overcome, are very strongly in your mind. And they've got a very important element within movements for creating unity, for giving people sense of purpose. So I'm not saying necessarily we're going to get We Shall Overcome out of this process, but I think it's really important to be creative around big issues that humanity's tackling, and what's bigger than climate change, really. So I'm excited to see what young people have got to say about this issue. And like I say, I think they've got an ability to be direct that many adults dance around. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we get.
Now, you work on CBeebies as well. You're doing everything, RSPB, marine biologist, all kinds of things. when you're talking to children, do you get that sense of awareness that this is something they care about? And you know, is there knowledge out there?
Yes, I mean, I just think about, and I don't know what you think about this, both of you two, you know, when you were young and what awareness you had of the environment or human impacts on the environment and nature, but I can see that children, and you know, children that I've met through our TV programmes and just, you know, out and about with my kids, have a much greater awareness of humanity's impact on the environment and nature than the generations before. So I really do see that they've got a connection and a knowledge that I didn't personally have. There's a slight disconnect, I think, between the experience that young people are able to have out in nature, for example, and you know, reports out this week that parents aren't letting their kids out until 2 years older than they were allowed out. And I think there's that strange sort of dissonance between this increased awareness about some of the problems we're facing and the lowered experience that many children are having out in nature. So I think it's really important to connect those two things, and being creative about it is one way to do that, I think.
How on earth do you go about it? Because you've no idea what you're going to get in. It could be a complete, you know, grab bag of anything, potentially. How on earth do you go about judging something like this?
So we're going to be, there's six of us judging, and we're going to be split into pairs. So there'll be three sets of us. And basically, the initial judging is going to be done with the Scottish Library and an Information Council, and they'll be helping to whittle it down to 45. So then we among our peers are going to help bring that down. So with 15 each, down to 9 overall in sort of each category. So we'll be paired up with another judge. So the other judges are children's writers like Anne Fine and Dean Atta. There's myself, there's the Scots Book and Word poet, Len Penny, and there's the athlete and television presenter, JJ Chalmers, and your colleague, Janice Forsyth as well. So some great judges there. I'm feeling a little bit out of my depth with people who are very, very au fait with words, and then a biologist. But at least, you know, I know the subject matter, so I know my place there. But it could be anything, really, to be honest. It can be a poem, it can be an essay, a monologue. I really like hip-hop, so I hope we get a few raps as well, and that can be my specialist subject. But I'm sort of open to whatever is produced. And it's under 500 words, so really, you know, being concise and clear and cutting through is the important thing here.
Under 500 words, that's the worrying bit. You know, there's no problem writing screeds and screeds and screeds, but once you've got to condense it down and actually focus it, it's a bit of a tack on. Rory, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
Great, thanks very much.
No problem. And we'll look forward to seeing what the results of this is. There's a link to all the information and terms and conditions for BBC Radio Scotland's Climate Tales competition on our website. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, well, I don't know how you possibly could, but there are a few ways of listening again.
There are loads, but probably the easiest way is look up BBC Sounds.
Or download the Free Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We always ask for where they listen to the podcast, where they consume the product. You can email us that information at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Sorley Johnson did. He says, I'm writing this as the hail lashes down again, and I wonder if the Gulf Stream has been switched off. There's actually some alarming information about that coming online at the moment. I'm now back living in Shetland after many years in Aberdeenshire, most specifically near Afford, so it was wonderful to hear Mike Ward and your piece on the Grampian Trance Museum, in which I have spent many happy hours.
Yeah, he goes on to say, I often listen to the podcast on my headphones as I go about the garden or the polycrub. I'd never heard of a polycrub, but he goes on, it's a wonderful Shetland invention using polycarbonate sheets and old fish farm pipes, ideal for the harsh conditions at 60 degrees north and designed to stand winds of over 100 miles an hour. They're now exported all over the UK and abroad, as far as the Falkland Islands. And a lot of people get in touch about the mystery bird and some complaints, which is fantastic, but have a wee listen to this first. So if you know what that is, and it's not a goshawk, you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
You've just broken Andrew and Kendall's heart, who thought it was a goshawk. He says, enjoyed the piece on adders at Muir of Dinnet. Have seen them a few times in Glenderry area on Mar Lodge Estate. Will and Gala Shields thought it was a kestrel, but pretty big butch kestrel, Will. Says, walking in the southern uplands way yesterday from Traquair to Yare Bridge, I heard a cuckoo. Nothing unusual in that, you might say, except that it was, and you know the answer to this, except that it was just calling the cook. No coup at all. Any thoughts? Speak, Mr. McElroy.
Well, I'm kind of dumbfounded by that. It changes, because you usually get the cuckoo, and then about the middle of June it goes, cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. But I've never heard a cook.
It's maybe just teenage one. You know, that sort of everything.
It's a juvenile, and they're just learning to do the... And somebody will come along and say, no, you need a coo at the end of it.
No, somebody, there's probably a teenage cuckoo out there just going, it's cook, obvs. Ian Johnson in Tallinnessy says, only heard a brief bit of this morning's mystery bird. Is it possibly a red-throated diver? Is spending part of today planning a three-day sea kayak camping trip for next week now that we can get back out. Hurrah! And this is a lovely family story. It's Sheila, Orchard Park, East Renfrewshire. Our family holidays were, for many years, 2 weeks at Kinkelbrae's Caravan Park at St Andrews. So many memories, but one which stands out is when there was a thick haar at the West Sands, which didn't stop us at all. My mum, aunt, sister Carol and I skipped down to the sea singing Morecambe and Wise's Bring Me Sunshine, and Bring the water was so warm. When you're smart. Finding our way back to our belongings took a wee while. It's no use. We're going to have to walk back to the caravan naked.
Neil Wincur's been in touch from North Wales, and he said, I really want to share this memory. We used to go to Aberdeen on holiday, and my extended family lived there. There was no dual carriageway, so we had to go through Arbroath, Montrose, and I remember that. It used to take forever. They were going up, and an old beat-up transit van went past with the police written on the side. Mum said, that's not a police van. My dad said, no, it's a new band called the Police.
That's a good one.
An early gig, yeah.
Must have been a very early gig. Over the past wee while, we've been taking a look at the stories of local folk that have just got really interesting backgrounds of stories. Some of which have kind of fallen from popular memory. And this is one that I recall, but from a television series.
Yeah, I knew nothing about this. I remember the television series called The Monocled Mutineer in the 80s, rather. It was a BBC drama. And I was filming this for Landward up at the Lecht about the amazing tale of Percy Topless. And if you're a certain age like Mark, you might remember it. But I got the real story from local historian Jennifer Stewart.
Percy Topless came from a very impoverished background in Chesterfield. And in the First World War, he was a stretcher bearer and he saw service in the trenches and also in Gallipoli and in India. When he was in leave on the First World War, he would be going back to London and he liked to pose in an officer's uniform with a gold monocle. But he was taking part in a lot of fraud and embezzlement. So it was like quite a few other people who could see the opportunities which were afforded by the chaos of the war.
So he's pretending to be an officer to swindle money?
That's right, yes, yeah. And also, I think, to draw ladies as well. I'm pretty certain that was going on because, of course, a lot of them would have lost their men to the First World War. And so he would have been after the richer ladies.
So there he is. He's a petty criminal. He poses as an officer now and again. But then he steps over the mark big time.
That's right. He deserted from the British Army and then he was carrying out various petty crimes. And at some stage he ended up in Hampshire and he allegedly murdered a taxi driver. And to escape the police, he went first to Wales and then he went up north, he went up to Aberdeen, and then he made his way out here to Tomintowel.
Because it's remote. Anybody that knows Scotland, it's the road up to the Lecht. But at that time, this Bothy would have been really remote.
It would have been. It was really far out, and of course, it didn't have the nice big roads that we now have across the Lecht. It would have been really difficult, particularly in winter time. So what we don't know is, did he come here deliberately or was he just making use of different opportunities to get as far away from population and the police?
And what, he spent a couple of weeks here and he nicked a bike?
That's right. Now, he could have nicked a bike when he was coming from Aberdeen out here, or he might have found one locally. But we think he stayed at the Bothy for about a fortnight, if you look at the timing of the murder of the taxi driver and the 1st of June when there was a shootout here.
Well, we'll come to that in a second, but a local gamekeeper was up here and he saw a bit of smoke coming from the Bothy chimney when it was supposed to be empty. So he went back to Tom and Towel to get recruits.
That's right, yes. He went to get George Gregg, who was the local policeman. The interesting thing is that George Gregg had originally been in Glasgow, in the Glasgow police, and he had his hands badly injured with knife battles there. And he thought by moving and going to the Banffshire Constabulary, he would have a quiet life.
And that was about to change, because they came back. The three of them was John Grant, a local farmer as well. What happened then?
Well, John Grant had a key, so they opened up, and bear in mind that it was about 9 o'clock at night, so it was dark inside. They found Topless sleeping there, so they accosted him and wanted to know what happened to the furniture in the bothy. And he said, oh, the furniture's in the next room. He went to the next room, came out immediately with a Webley gun, and shot the policeman in the shoulder, and also shot the farmer in the thigh. And in the stramash that happened, the three men managed to get away and they made their way to Tom and Towel, and Topless then escaped on his bike to Aberdeen.
And he got a train there. The guys are lying injured, but the policeman still sounded the alarm.
That's right. The local policeman was then able to alert the national police, so they were on the lookout. And he got as far as Penrith. And the local police were a bit suspicious of him. They stopped him, he pulled a gun, and they then shot him. And that was the end of Topless. He is now buried in an unmarked grave in Penrith. He was only 23.
The two guys, the policeman and the farmer, made a full recovery. I mean, did Geordie go back to Glasgow for a quiet life?
Well, he didn't go back to Glasgow, but he did have to take sick leave, and I believe he ended up in Cummingstown.
It's hard to believe that whole history of that shootout, which came to be known as the Tom and Towel outrage, happened in this remote glen in Scotland.
Yes, I know. It's surprising for us, but bear in mind, of course, certainly before the First World War, that these glens would have been populated by lots of families, but they lost their men in the First World War here.
It must have been a real shock to the local people, those that did make it back.
Yes, and the outrage, I think, was also because here was three local men who had been shot at. They were trying to do their best for the local communities, trying to find out what was going on. And here was an incomer who had taken advantage of the situation.
Jennifer Stewart there, and the tale of Percy Topless, and you can hear more about that story on Landward in the coming weeks. Really not a nice individual at all.
No, he wasn't a nice individual, but something's weird, Mark, just in that really lonely glen, thinking about the shootout. You know, there's so many stories, because you've uncovered a whole pile as well.
Yeah.
And you know, if folk have got stories about people or things that have slipped from popular memory, then email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
We've got some incorrect answers on the mystery bird. Now, bear in mind, this is where the real honour lies. It's not getting it right. You know, nobody likes a smarty pants. We're getting the wrong answer, particularly a gifted one. You know, that's it. Susie in Spot says, is the mystery bird a crane? No, it's not, Susie, but thank you for taking part. Alistair Kostorfen says, is it a guillemot? Enjoying programme as ever as sun rises over Kostorfen Hill. Rose Scott Blackall, this is very specific. Is it a gull in a geo? That's a cut into the coast. Well, a geo is basically a cut into the coastline. You know, it's almost like a sort of wee ravine bit. And then adds greater blackback. Inspired row, but quite wrong. Catherine Galashiel says, been racking my brains to remember when I've heard this before. Is it a guillemot? Nope. Barbie Shorten Troon says, magpie from Glorious Sunny Troon. Magpie from Glorious Sunny Troon? Oh, well, never mind. Rose Johnson in Aletheian says, is the mystery bird a capercaillie? Adds, I really like Ewan's poetry. Has he ever written a book? Only a matter of time. I would imagine, Rose.
Hold me back.
Had you back. And a complaint has flooded in from Mike Crutch.
At last. You
know, yeah, because we were talking about the mystery nightbird that we'd heard, and we couldn't figure out what it was, and I impersonated it by whistling it. The correct answer is a golden plover, right? We've established that categorically. Mike has said, look, I said golden plover 2 weeks ago. Tell Mark to listen to us the next time.
Ooh.
Listen, Mr. Crutch. I'm the presenter. I'm the one that's supposed to have artistic temperament.
Yeah, but he's right.
Yes, of course he's right, but that's not the point. Anyway, thanks very much for getting in contact, Mike. We do appreciate it. Back to the journey I was making along the Aberdeen Coastal Trail. I'd reached the beach esplanade in Aberdeen, which is still glorious. I mean, used to be a real attraction. Memories of days go by just came flooding back.
Aberdeen used to be a very serious holiday destination. I've got an old poster in the house. And I can't remember which railway, but it basically said, you know, come to the golden sands of Aberdeen. And I mean, the sands are golden. A bonny, bonny place. It's great like a day like today, because the sea is blue further out. It's churning up the sand closer in. But I can feel the spray in my face. Shadows of gulls in the water. This is lovely. It's really bracing. They used to have Punch and Judy shows on the beach. Churches would hold summer camps on the beaches too. There were almost like fair shows, sports, you name it. All sorts of things happened there. I remember my grandfather, Grand Akai, telling me a story that he and his brother had been practicing, aiming to compete at throwing the hammer. And they'd found an old, you know, basically a sledgehammer. And they were down on the beach practicing, you know, swing, 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 throw, swing, 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 throw. And I can't remember if it was Da or his brother mistimed it, but it shot off in entirely the wrong direction, went straight through the roof of a little watchman's hut, landed in his brazier, throwing hot coals in all directions. And with tremendous presence of mind, they ran away. You know, in the era of Harry Lauder, Aberdeen had its own version in the form of Harry Gordon. And Harry Gordon had a theatre up here. And a lot of his humour was based around this fictional place called Inversnecky. But there's a cafe up here now called the Inversnecky. And I've been right through to the back of it. And they still have part of the stage, part of the proscenium arch, at the back, the very, very back of the cafe. Well, I say that. It's 10 years since I've seen it. I assume it's still there. I don't know.
And in for snakey bank day for I go up and down the stairs.
Every bench has got a few people sitting on it.
Oh, watching all the spoony couples sitting there in pairs.
There's joggers and cyclists and dog walkers and everything else. It's great to see folk enjoying the fresh air. And skateboarders.
When you come down, you'll maybe land an Inversnecky.
Hello, do you do carry out coffee?
Of course we do.
Right, can I have a latte to carry out, please?
No problem, that's £3 for
these. That's fine, thank you.
This is a good sign. Every one of these cafes has got a queue outside it. Yeah, and folk are keeping the distance, they've been quite sensible. That's good. Tell you what, Will have noticed a big, big difference. There are some fairly piratical gulls. And starlings come to that, because whenever possible, we come here and we sit outside and eat. They do a very good breakfast. But it's not unknown for a seagull to drop like a stone from the sky and nick half your breakfast. Just always good for a fight. Something right fine about sitting in the sunshine, watching the sea, a cup of coffee or an ice cream. I went for the coffee. I came down one of the sets of steps here. Bike in one hand, a cup of coffee in the other hand, microphone tucked underneath my arm. And I was trying to steer the bike one-handed towards the last remaining bench when suddenly this little old man ran past me and threw himself onto the bench. I looked at him and I said, oh, so that's why you're running. He says, oh, aye, but I've got my Hale family. Never mind, there's plenty of room in the grass. Somebody's got a proper beach volleyball net up and they're actually playing proper beach volleyball, curiously enough. But you get people coming here surfing, quite a lot of stand-up paddle boarders, that kind of thing. Lots of runners and cyclists. There's not so many out there today, but one of the great sights here from Aberdeen Beach are the supply boats, you know, the taxi boats. They just stay offshore and they wait until there's a need for them. and then they'll come in to the harbour and pick up whatever it is that's actually required. They pay the harbour dues for the time they're actually in the harbour. But offshore, nothing, I don't think. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 huge offshore wind turbines. They're just turning lazily today. Each of them is topped on the nacelle by this little flashing light. You can't really see it at the moment, but at night time they all flash synchronously. Okay, it's quite attention grabbing. So effectively that's me done the full length of what's called the Aberdeen Coastal Route, and I'm going to review it as honestly as I can. The first section, from Cove up to the outskirts of Torry, where they're building the new harbour, I think is pretty good. You know, it's off-road, some fantastic scenery, great wildlife. I really enjoyed it. Trying to get past Ballinagas Golf Course, though, to carry on with what I would have considered to be the coastal route, is not easy. I certainly could not recommend cycling through Aberdeen Harbour. It's fascinating and there's a lot to see there, and if you like big ships, it will be the place for you. Once you get past that, however, and you're onto the quieter back roads, once you're onto the sort of, you know, the edge of the harbour itself, beside the River Dee, heading for Fitty, it becomes nice again. Fitty's lovely, thoroughly recommend it. What I've just done there, running up beside the beach for probably about the last 2 miles, is lovely. And there's plenty of places to get an ice cream or a coffee or things like that. And here you can see lots of birds, plenty of wildlife, seals, you name it. And this might be a bit controversial, I actually quite enjoy watching the marine wind turbines. So if they could join up that gap in the middle and make it bike friendly or walker friendly, I would give it 9 out of 10.
Wait, collectively as a team, we are in love with our audio supremo, Ron McCaskill's choice of music on these pieces so far, and we've come up with an idea for an art installation. As you go along the beach esplanade in Aberdeen, you sit down at one of those benches and that kind of music starts to play. I mean, I would go and do that. That would be brilliant, yeah, right?
What's your idea of happiness? Listening to Hammond organ and watching windmills go round and round.
Yeah, and if a scone and a cup of tea came out of the ground at the same time on a little platform thing, I tell you, you know. They make a fuss about the Turner Prize. That's art, mate.
Aye, but how does that Hammond get that distinctive sound?
Oh, tell me, do.
Well, the speakers were on a swivel, so they're going round and round and round, and that's why you get that slight Doppler effect.
Ah, see, I didn't know that. You know,
and not
see,
been a wasted morning after
no,
all.
No, and it is illegal to play a Hammond organ without a ruffled shirt. I don't know if you're doing that. But Nan Shepherd's book, The Living Mountain, has become one of the most celebrated works in nature writing to come out of Scotland. In it, amongst other things, she describes the watercourses of the Cairngorms in really quite incredible detail.
Yeah, she spent most of her life in Colts, suburb of Aberdeen, and just a stone's throw from the River Dee. In The Living Mountain, she writes about finding its source, close to the summit of Brerea.
Now, in an upcoming feature for BBC Radio 3, book in hand, our own Helen Needham followed in Nan's footsteps to that very place. It's a lovely listen. It's literally an immersive piece. Here's a flavour.
One cannot know the rivers till one has seen them at their sources. But this journey to the sources is not to be undertaken lightly. One walks among elementals, and elementals are not governable. They are awakened also in oneself. by the contact elementals that are as unpredictable as wind or snow. As I stand there in the silence, I become aware that the silence is not complete. Water is speaking. I go towards it. Almost at once the view is lost, for the plateau has its own hollows, and this one slopes widely down to one of the great inward fissures, the Garv Corrie. It lies like a broad leaf veined with watercourses that converge on the lip of the precipice to drop down in a cataract for 500 feet. This is the River Dee. Astonishingly, up here at 4,000 feet, it is already a considerable stream.
listening to this, if you're listening to this lying in bed, I bet you're not anymore. And you can hear the full version of Helen's slow radio programme, Nan Shepherd's River, The Dee, on BBC Radio 3 at 11:30 Sunday evening, or any time after that on BBC Sounds. It is a lovely, quite literally, immersive listen. Now, Mystery Bird, wrong answers for this week. And as I said before, this is where the real, you know, honour lies. Heaps of people thought it was gannets. Marion in Geary, Bill and Anne in Macduff. They're sitting in bed with a cup of tea in Macduff. Kenny in Elgin, Liz Taylor in Broughty Ferry. Liz is doing yoga in Broughty Ferry. Good on her.
Listening to us?
Well, apparently it's possible.
How can that be?
And it's legal too, apparently. Who knew? Callum in Balmermer thought it was a heron, as did Rosie in Cooper Angus. Keith Sutherland in Blairgowrie thought it was a raven, as did John McKenzie in Orkney. And there's a couple of wild cards here too, if I can find them. Moira Toohey in Broughty Ferry thought it was a shag, and Ian McDade in Fintry thought it might be the elusive black grouse, none of which are correct.
No.
We actually got remarkably few correct answers, and I'll do a name check of them afterwards. But this is actually the mystery bird for this week, and it is the just stunning, wonderful, beautiful, magnificent sea eagle.
The first rays of the morning sun scythed through the mist that hung over the headland. The high priest turned to the east and began the chant of mourning. The celebration of a chief, the father of a tribe, and the rock of those who lived and eked out a living on South Royalty. For over 1,000 years, the chiefs of this land had been laid to rest in the chambered cairn, perched above the dramatic cliffs that face to the rising sun. Stooping low, he crawled into the shallow shaft which led to the heart of the cairn, the tomb of the eagles. Earlier that week, two young men had descended the rocky cliff, risking life and limb as they reached the nest in darkness, reaching out over the mass of sticks and feathers to grasp the prize, a sacrifice worth that of a chief. For the eagle with the sunlit eye would help lead their chief to find peace in the afterlife, soaring over land and sea to find eternal rest. The sea eagle is special. The remains of over 50 birds were found in the tomb of the eagles, a site used by a Neolithic man for thousands of years. The symbolism of the eagle, unknown, but it's a bird revered the world over. Highland chiefs added three eagle feathers to bonnets as a sign of rank. Native Americans added them to their headdresses, putting them in touch with the creator of life. A lone bird on a crag warned of the arrival of an enemy. Two birds, the symbol of peace. In Fetlar, the tale is told of baby Mary Anderson being taken by an eagle. A local boy, Robert Nicholson, is said to have climbed the cliffs to rescue her from the nest. The eagle bairn. Many years later, Mary and her hero Robert were married, and now descendants the world over are still known as eagle bairns. The sea eagle is a magnificent bird, up to 8 feet wingspan. It has to be seen to be believed, and it dwarfs all other birds. And to see one in action taking a fish is a true delight. Fishermen in Shetland were so in awe of the bird's prowess, they used to smear eagle fat on their bait to guarantee a large catch. Persecuted to extinction here, they were virtually extinct by 1900. The last successful mating pair survived on Skye till 1916. And the final bird was shot in England 2 years later. Extinct after decades of persecution. In the 18th century, the British government offered a bounty of 5 shillings for every eagle killed. Many others had eggs destroyed. Long before guns, men would lay out bait and then hide in a shallow pit. As the eagle arrived, they would reach out and grab the bird's leg, the eagle's surprisingly calm and accepting
once caught. And it wasn't just Britain. In the 19th century, war was declared on seagulls throughout Europe. In Romania, one man alone was responsible for killing 400 birds. The same number killed every year in Germany. In Norway, between 1959 and 1968, an average of 169 were killed every year, with 221 taken in 1968. Add that to the ravages of DDT, and the fact that this bird survives at all is a miracle. There were some laws put in place to protect the sea eagle, and the Reverend Ernest Sorby was fined the equivalent of £1,500 for killing a bird in Yell in 1904. Attempts were made at reintroduction in Glen Etive in 1959, which failed. A similar project in Fair Isle in 1968 was also doomed. Before a reintroduction on Rum in 1975 finally saw them establish a toehold. Two more reintroductions followed in Wester Ross before 85 birds were released on the east coast. And finally, in 2015, a pair of sea eagles finally nested in Orkney for the first time in 150 years.
And a very well done to the few people this week who actually got it correct.
Too hard.
Andrew Barry in Broxburn, said Sea Eagle, Ross in Tainault, Ian Ross in Blackburn, Donald McGregor, Ian Strathbeffer, Mike Crutch, ornithologist, has been back in touch saying, the recording you played after 6:30 is different to the one you just played. So white-tailed eagle. Yep, you're absolutely correct, Mike. Well done. And Doogie Dargy in Glenroth has said, no badge required. I wish we had badges, Doogie, I really do, but we don't. And even if we did, we probably wouldn't be allowed to hand them out. I was talking earlier, one of the sort of comments earlier was that it sounded a bit like a seagull, and I said, in a geo, which is a feature. It's almost like a cut into a cliff. Martin Prentice from Kirsten Stromness says, we need to tell you that geo is not pronounced geo, it comes from the Norse. It's like the word go with a hard G, g, and y in the middle, and the stress on the long O, so geo. We wouldn't want the folk in Orkney and Shetland to be laughing at you any longer. Actually, it's nice here, Martin, but we're used to it, has to be said. Did you have any correct answers?
No, I didn't get any correct answers, but I did have a lovely holiday email from Fiona. It said, my dad left my mum to run the family business. She didn't like camping. We went from Stirling to Carnoustie. Dad had a four-burner gas cooker, but only one pot. So sausages with smash added and the beans in one pot borrowed. But we did have a tent with a sewn-in ground sheet. Wow.
See, that's posh. Wow. That is posh. We used to go on camping holidays. There was four kids. I was the eldest. And it was a six-man army tent. Because remember, we got it out of Millets. It had wooden poles. And there was Mum, Dad, and all of us sleeping in there. And my youngest brother, Bruce, I think was still in the pram at the time, Loch Erne. And we stayed at the same site for about 4 or 5 days and drank the lovely, refreshing mountain water, only to discover there was a dead sheep further upstream at the time. Anyway, we need to say farewell and thank you very much to Sam, who basically mans the phones and has done for a couple of years now. Today was the last time he'll have somebody shouting bird names down the phone at him, which I'm sure he'll miss. We'll certainly miss him here out of doors. And that, sadly, is it from us. Don't forget the Scotland Outdoors podcast at Name Today, and look out for the midweek podcast, which this week features author Roger Morgan Gredville. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.